Okay, I think we'll go ahead and get started. What we're going to do today is I'm going to give you kind of a brief overview of copyright law, working on the assumption that since that's the title, that's what y'all are interested in hearing about. So I'm going to give you a little overview of copyright law, what it is, what it isn't, hopefully clear up a few misconceptions before we start. What I've discovered is when I speak to non-legal crowds, they often have really interesting ideas, many of which are just wrong. And so I'm going to try to clear up some misconceptions you have, because I mean, y'all aren't lawyers for the most part. Do I have lawyers looking out there? I just have to ask. Okay. Then I can say any stuff and you'll believe me. No one can catch me. I always like that. But so I'm going to give you the overview of what the law is. We'll have plenty of time. So I know a lot of y'all are coming with particular questions. If your question is too detailed, don't be offended when I tell you to talk to me afterwards, because everyone in here has stuff to say and wants to hear about stuff. And if you have something really, really psycho-narrow, it was exactly your particular point, and realistically no one else cares, I'm going to ask you just to hold that, and I'll talk to you afterwards. So I'm not just blowing you off. I'll talk to you afterwards, but some particular questions are just too detailed, and the answer starts to be too much of a, well, it depends on these many different things, and everyone else in the room is snoozing off, and you still won't get your answer, because I'll need to just talk to you one-on-one about it. So, that being said, I'm Courtney. I practice in intellectual property law here in Atlanta. I also teach at Emory Law School. If I were doing what I should be right now, I'd be working on the teacher's manual of the book that they're waiting to publish because I haven't finished the teacher's manual. So that's what I should be doing right now, but it's DragonCon, so I'm here to talk to you. I like this crowd. All right, lawyers never get applause, nor do professors. Professors get applauded at the end of the last class of the semester. And we like to tell ourselves that the students are expressing their appreciation of the wisdom we've shared and all that they've learned, whereas we know they're just thankful that the semester's over. And they're trying to suck up because we're about to grade their exams. But, you know, so it's kind of like, oh, wow. And that's at the beginning of the show. So, copyright law is something that is intended by the government to protect certain kinds of intellectual property. There's three main kinds of intellectual property. You've got patent, trademark, and copyright. Patent is the hard one. Lawyers have to have actually done real hard science in order to go be patent lawyers. It is one of the few, if not the only, areas of law where you must be separately credentialed to practice it. I cannot be a patent lawyer because I'm not smart enough to do hard science. I'm really good with words. The standard joke amongst attorneys is if we could do math and science, we'd be doctors. And it's kind of a lawyer joke because we all just look at the floor and walk away because, yeah, we know it's true. There's a few rare birds, one of whom just left the room, who do both. They're patent lawyers. They did hard science undergrad, and now they are a member of the patent bar. If any of you end up with an invention, I mean like a hardcore machine kind of invention, most software programs do not amount to patentable subject matter. A few do, most do not. But if you do have some cool invention, a thing that does something, and you want to patent it, the bad news is it's very expensive and it takes a long time. The worst news is none of those places on TV or the internet that say they will help you patent your product are telling you the truth. What they will do is take your money and then ask you some questions, and they may or may not send you a piece of garbage that they tell you to go ahead and send to the patent office. Don't waste your money. If you've got something you really need to patent, talk to a real patent attorney. They must be a member of the patent bar. There are things non-patent attorneys can do for you, but you really shouldn't use them. You should never give me money to help you with a patent, because that'd be stupid. Find a real patent lawyer if you're in that area. But keep in mind, unless you are made of money, I mean, $10,000 is about what it'll cost to prosecute one for real. Unless you have that kind of money in a couple years, find another way. That's patents. We won't talk about it much. Trademarks. Everyone knows trademarks because they've seen them. And this is the first time I've ever spoken where no one in the front two rows is holding a Coke can. Okay, someone has something trademarked. Hold up something with a logo. Ha! Scott, you've got me covered here. Minute Maid, also a Coke product. Minute Maid. Minute Maid is a trademark. You cannot copyright a name of a product. The purpose of trademarks is to identify the source of this product. It is not, contrary to popular belief, to protect Coca-Cola from people taking some of their money. It has nothing to do with protecting Coca-Cola. Trademark is intended to protect you. So when you pick up a can that says Minute Maid, you know what's in it and who it's from. Minute Maid is actually interesting in that they are, until Minute Maid started doing this, it was just an absolute piece of accepted gospel in the marketing business that you never use black to advertise food. And if you think about it, there's no good connotation between colors of death and food. So that's a color you just did not use on a food label. Minute Maid said, ta-ha, yes we can. And it became a very distinctive label. When you see the Kroger frozen juice next to the Minute Maid frozen juice, and you notice that the Kroger frozen juice is in a black labeled canister as well, you know that it's not because they're trying to tell you it's orange juice. It's because they're trying to hide next to the Minute Maid and get you to buy it. But so trademark identifies the source of the product. You know it's made by Minute Maid. You know if you get that can, you know what you're getting. If it says Nike, you know it was made somewhere in China, I guess, and shipped to us, but you know what you're getting. It's a consumer protection law, and it lasts as long as the mark is in use. So as long as Minute Maid continues to make juice and put their name on it, their trademark will just keep lasting and lasting. Unlike patent and copyright, both of which have a limited duration, trademark lasts as long as the company wants to use it. So if you are starting a company, if you're thinking that you're going to sell something, hypothetically on the internet, she says, taking a wild stab given this crowd, if you want to protect your name or the name of your product, sometimes that's actually the way to go about if you say patent. How long? How much? You know. If instead you can be the first one taking your clever invention to the market, give it a really cool name, protect the name. A trademark filing is fairly straightforward and simple. Like I said, to do a patent filing, you need a patent lawyer. Trademark filings, they're a little bit complicated the first time you do one, but you can work your way through it if you're vaguely intelligent. You can also call the trademark office in Washington. Don't do the online chat stuff. Actually, call them on the phone. They have reference attorneys that will answer the phone. Well, they won't answer the phone. They'll transfer you a few times, then you get the reference attorney. And they will help you with it. If you have questions, if you're filing a trademark, they will help you with it. It's about $325 to register a trademark. Not cheap, but not unreasonable. So if you're looking to protect that thing without being able to patent it, sometimes trademark's your answer. I'm saying this to get out of the way so we can get to what copyright is. This is what it isn't. But if you have like a book title, if you have a catchy slogan, if you have a label that you want to identify your product with, that's all trademark. Like I said, the registration is fairly straightforward. The people in Washington actually will help. They won't give you really good legal advice. That's not what they do. But if you have questions as you're filling it out, if you are, I don't know what this means. What do you mean international class? There's a pretty good set of FAQs on the trademark site. And like I said, do not hesitate to call the attorney number and they will talk to you. And if they can't answer something, they'll say, I can't tell you that. You need to hire a lawyer to do that. But you can get some pretty good use from them. If you are looking to do something like that, or if you're still thinking about patents, don't look on the internet for information. There's a lot of bullshit out there, okay? We pay a lot of money to go to school for a lot of years and then practice for a long time before we know what we're talking about. We don't give it away for free. Anyone who is, there's a reason. And you're probably going to get what you pay for. Under no circumstances, and I say that knowing that I'm going to give you the exception to this later in the talk, use a form or a contract or something that you downloaded off the internet. A contract is only as good as the person who wrote it and the communication they had with their client to make sure that the contract matches the client's circumstances. So if you download something for free or get something off of, LegalZoom? Yeah, no. A will? Yeah, okay, probably, but that's not the topic of this conversation. You can get those at Office Depot, for pity's sake. But something complex, this is something you've spent some time creating that you want to protect. And that's why most of y'all are in here, because you're interested in something along those lines. If you've put the time into creating this thing, don't screw up the last step by paying $40 for some piece of crap off the internet. You're going to ruin all the work you've put into your creative project. It's worth doing it right. And the trademark's fairly easy. Anyway, those are the things that copyright is not. Here's the stuff copyright is. Copyright is really in place to protect the really creative and artistic-y stuff. Like I said, trademark is consumer protection, identifies the source of the good or the service. Patent is the real cool science-y stuff. Copyright is all the artsy stuff and software. Software is not a real good fit for copyright. You'll find a lot of things that I talk through today don't make much sense for copyright, or I'll say that, wow, and then we did this to software, and it makes no sense. It just makes no sense. Software should not be included in copyright. If I ran the world, it would not be, because it's just a stupid fit for how the law is structured and how it's intended to work. But nevertheless, software is covered by copyright, so we deal with it. So your books, your art, dances, music, movies, all of the creative things in pretty much any form are copyright, but they have to be in some form. The key for copyright protection is that it must be fixed in a tangible medium. That means it can't just be an idea in your head. One of the most common questions I get when I'm talking to the non-legal world, where they're kind of trying to get some free legal advice, and I do that, it's no problem, I'll give you some basic ideas here. They come up with, I've got this great idea. Well, that's great. Ideas are not protectable. In copyright, the idea here is to give the author a limited monopoly to incentivize the author to create. Copyright's actually a little backwards. When you think of copyright, you think, I wrote this book, so now I'm protected. It's my book, I wrote it, I get to exploit it. That's not what copyright's actually about. Just like, in spite of what Coca-Cola people would like it to be, trademark is not about protecting all the money they've put into marketing Minute Maid. Trademark's about protecting you. When you get to copyright, it's actually in the Constitution. The founders came up with this, and they put it in there because they want to incentivize the progress of the science and the arts. Patent and copyright are the same section of the Constitution, and it is purely for the creation and the progress and the promotion of the arts and the sciences. But they knew that the way to encourage authors to create is to make sure they can feed their family by doing so. So the way that they want to incentivize it is by providing a limited monopoly over the thing you've created. This is different than if you built a house. If you built a house, God knows how you'd actually do that these days, but say you could build a house, you would then own that house, and you would own it pretty much until it fell in around your ears. Then you'd still own the dirt underneath it. That's property. You own it until you get rid of it, or it falls apart, or you sell it, or someone steals it, or whatever. Intellectual property in the form of a copyright is only yours until the government stops protecting it. And they do it for a limited period of time, because what the copyright laws are really intended to do is to make sure that there's good stuff out there in the public domain for everyone else to use. If you don't write the great novel, if you don't paint the great painting, nothing will be out there in the public domain, so you're incentivized by that money. So you get the limited time duration of copyright, and it applies now as soon as you fix it in a tangible medium, as soon as you write it, as soon as you draw it, as soon as you record it, if it's a spoken voice. I sort of have notes for my talk today. Those notes are protected by copyright as soon as I wrote them down weeks ago when I was preparing to do this. Those notes are protected. My speech itself, since it has very little relation to the notes on my sheet there, you can probably guess since I've looked at it maybe twice since I got up here. My speech itself would not be protected except that these nice guys back here are recording it, which always makes me a little nervous, but I'm getting used to it. It's only been how many years that I've been doing this? I finally thought, like, oh God, I'm being recorded. It makes me nervous. But since they're recording it, this is actually protected as I speak it, because it is being fixed in a tangible medium by my friends behind me. Film counts as a medium. When you type it on your computer and store it in the memory of your computer, that counts as a tangible medium. There are a few cases about that when people first said, oh my God, it's a computer, is it tangible? Well, yes, it is. If I write something on a blackboard, it's pretty much not, because we know that's going to be erased very quickly. If I wrote something on a blackboard and took a picture of it, well, that would be fixed in a tangible medium. Until it's fixed in a tangible medium, it is not protectable under copyright. The only thing that's protectable is what is fixed. So if I have my notes here, which, you know, you can see are excessive. That would be all that would be protected if they weren't recording this. So everything else I said would be public domain because it's not fixed. It is fixed. Ha ha ha. You can't steal it like you would. There's also something to be said for the best way to protect things is do things like I do where no one wants it anyway. So, fixed and tangible medium is your key. Your ideas are not protectable. What you still want to do, however, if it's something good, I mean, if this is the book you've written, if this is, you know, 10 poems that you've done that you've really bled into, if this is the art that you've spent months working on, go ahead and register the silly thing. You technically are covered by federal copyright as soon as it's fixed. If it's something you think you care about, go ahead and register it. It is the easiest of the three to do. You do not need a lawyer to do it. Go on to copyright.gov. It takes you down through the thing. There's a few words you haven't heard before because we're lawyers. We refuse to use words the way the rest of you people do. And there'll be a few things on there that you go, huh? But look at it twice. You'll figure out it is not a difficult form. And again, if it is, they have FAQs that are fairly helpful, and they have people that are not as helpful as trademark, but not bad. You can do it yourself. Now, it's kind of become a standard joke, so I say this in here every year. Putting it in an envelope and mailing it to yourself is just a waste of the cost of postage. I hear that called the poor man's copyright. The poor man's copyright is the one with the federal government. It's $35 for pity's sake. That's the poor man's copyright. You can afford to file a copyright on something you care about. Mailing it to yourself really is worthless. I put it akin to in a previous lifetime, I managed pools and ran waterfronts, and so I had all sorts of first aid training. And I remember the first time I took a first aid class, they told us very seriously not to put butter on a burn. I don't know. Apparently it's one of those old folksy remedies. Honey on wounds actually is supposed to work. So some condiments are good, some are bad. But butter on a burn. I mean, I guess because if... The only thing I can figure out is when I burn toast, by putting enough butter on it, you can still almost eat it. I don't know. But it's one of those folksy remedies that I had never heard of until I was taught by the Red Cross never to do it. And I'm like, well, how about mayonnaise? Mustard? I wouldn't have thought to do these things. But they say don't do it. Some of you had not heard this before, and so you're thinking, why would I do that? A lot of people think they would. At least someone in here is thinking, oh, well, the easy way to do it is mail it to yourself. It has absolutely no legal effect. Among the things that are out there that perfectly rational people believe is that, and it's completely wrong. It's not that people are foolish or stupid. Someone told you that. Someone sounded like they knew what they thought, and that they sounded very credible. And this is why, again, I warn you away from stuff on the internet. I can look through it and usually tell what's bullshit and what's not, but I've got a lot of years looking at this, and I know what the answers are. Anything on about trademarks that you have a question, the trademark page, the USPTO, U.S. Patent and Trademark Office, USPTO.gov, lots of good information there, very user-friendly, and it's correct because it's written by the people who do it. Same thing on copyright.gov. Lots of good information, not quite as robust as the trademark pages, but lots of good information, you can trust it. Most stuff put out by law schools is trustable. You've got to watch law professors, though. We have our own pet theories, and we do go on about them, especially in print. If you find like a contract, you know, or copyrights 101 sort of page on a law professor's blog or on a law school site, those are usually pretty good. They're often study aids for the students or something like that, and they're pretty reliable. You know, if a law professor at Stanford says it's true, it probably is. Shy of that, I hesitate. EFF has a lot of good stuff, of course. EFF, stop listening, Scott, has a lot of positions that they take very strongly, and if you are not careful, you will read through and mistake some of what they say for how it should be for how it is. So just be very careful when you take legal advice off the internet, because you care about the stuff you've made. Make sure what you're doing is absolutely correct, because if you get it slightly wrong, you screw the whole thing up. We're lawyers. We allow no errors. Okay, so we talked about registration, and for registration, just do it. If you have... Some people write poetry and they always say, well, do I have to register every poem? Because, you know, if you write 500 poems in a year, the $35 will add up. Well, put them in a compilation, register them 200 at a time, call it an anthology. Register it all, it's all protected. You also will, when you register, need to send in two copies of it to the Library of Congress. It's just part of the requirement, so print out two and send them along. They even now will print out the little mailing slip for you when you register online. All very user-friendly, all very simple. If you've built a huge sculpture, look through the FAQs. They will tell you when you have to send a copy, which is not for a huge sculpture. You take a picture and you send that. So make sure you do that. It increases your protection. If you think it's something that's going to be valuable enough to you that it's worth doing, do it right. Now, this
I love the stroller cover, by the way. That is just fantastic.
If I have a recipe,
mm-hmm.
That's a perfect transition to what I was about to talk about. What is and is not copyrightable? The short answer is no.
If it's a recipe that, although it's non-medical, it kind of cures a disease, then what?
Copyright does not care if it's useful or not. In fact, things that are useful tend to not be copyrightable. Go back to where we started. Copyright's the artsy stuff. If it serves a purpose, that purpose is not protectable. Copyright protects the expression of an idea. So the words you use in your poetry, the words you use in your novel, if, like me, you write about boring things that are factual-ish, the facts underlying what you say are not protected. Your recipe is, in effect, a factual list of how to make something. That factual list is not protectable. The fact how to make something, if it would be protectable at all, would be patentable, and chances are a recipe is not going to amount to the very high standards for patentability. So what's protectable under copyright is your expression of an idea. If you had a cookbook, the cookbook itself can be protected, sort of. What's protected in a cookbook would be your editing, basically, your selection of the recipes. If you arrange them in some order other than, like, alphabetical. If you arrange them creatively by, how likely they are to make your grandmother yell at you or something. That kind of original arrangement, the selection, and the way you lay it out may be copyrightable. So someone couldn't just copy your whole book or copy the guts of your book and put a different cover on it. But the actual recipes themselves will not be protected because copyright does not protect anything practical or useful. I'm not even saying that to be flip. That's actually in the code. If it's practical or useful, it is excluded from copyright. So if I write a history book, the history in my book is not protectable. If I actually found King Arthur's grave, and I could prove it was him, and I've dug through all of these old letters and all of this old stuff, and I consulted the correct people in a seance, and I threw some runestones, and I found King Arthur's actual tomb, and I don't know how you do DNA testing to prove it, but I did it, damn it. And so we have proven beyond a doubt, I have King Arthur's tomb right here at this hole in the ground in Glastonbury. Well, okay, the book I write about it, how I describe it, what I say in that book is protected. Where that is, the facts in my book are not. So if someone wants to take my book and say, oh, well, your long-winded story about how you went through lots of dusty archives and ate lots of mutton while you did it is not very interesting, I can spice this up and tell a much better story based on and still reveal the facts of King Arthur and what's in those letters and what the castles look like. All of those things, which I just spent tons of time, years of my life finding, are not protectable. The only thing protectable is the actual words I use in my book to describe this stuff myself. The actual things I found are not. There's a case that my students always read in my copyright class about an old Simon and Simon episode about a gangster who, Billy the Kid's not really dead, he lived on in California until recently. There's several of those, all sorts of famous dead people aren't actually dead. Jim Morrison's not dead, Elvis isn't dead. I lose track of how many of them aren't dead. But there's always lots of stories about how they're not dead. Well, if you wrote that as a novel, my great story of how I met Billy the Kid, at a truck stop 50 years ago, if I wrote it as fiction, everything in it is copyrightable. If I go through and say, no, I did the research, I looked at the molars in the dead guy's mouth, and I found all of these facts that prove my conclusion, anyone else can go take my book and lift those facts right out. Copyright's only about the expression, not about the useful or important stuff. So you can. So the seminal case in this, I kind of am pounding it in because this is, runs contrary to what people often think, because they often have something other than just fiction, and they think, I'm going to be protected because I'm going to tell all these great facts, you know. If you write it as fiction, it's protected. If you write it as fact, it is not. One of the first cases you read in a copyright class is about this long ago case, which we like old archaic stuff. It makes us feel important. So it's basically the guy who invented double column accounting. Wrote a textbook saying, here's this really great way that we can keep our books much more efficiently and much better. Well, his book didn't really catch fire, but someone else read it and said, hey, that's smart, and stole the accounting process, which this guy had invented. But I said accounting process. Processes are expressly excluded from copyright. So this guy basically stole this brand new accounting process, wrote a book that was popular, made scads of money, and when the heirs of the original guy sued this guy, they lost. He even copied complete tables and forms out of the book, and the court said, you know, you can't use this process without tables just like this, so you can just absolutely exactly copy the tables and the forms out of the back. That's not protected. Yeah?
See, now today, wouldn't the double accounting process be patentable as a business process?
Anything is patentable as a business process these days. The alphabetic filing system, I think, has been patented as an alphabetic process. Business patents are just stupid, as a general rule. And this is where law professors have their own pet issues, and they say stuff that isn't true. That's what I'm doing right now. Business patents should not exist. They're crap. It is ridiculous that one click with Amazon should or should, I'll get you next. Would be patentable or not. It's stupid that the idea of alphabetizing my files could be patentable. There is, I kid you not, and it's actually in my book, a patent that issued for swinging sideways on a swing.
On a stick. One for a wooden stick as well.
Yeah. One of the chapters.
Rule that out by it's not novel, it's not original.
Yes, none of these should have ever made it through the patent process. When I first started seeing some of the business patents come out, and then I saw this swinging sideways on a swing, I'm like, wait a minute. I'm not a patent lawyer, but I know the standards, novelty, usefulness, non-obviousness, and I'm thinking none of those are met by any of this crap.
If a two-year-old can do it, it's obvious.
It's obvious, yeah. And none of them are, you know, none of them are non-obvious, none of them are novel, and novel means no one has ever done it before anywhere in the history of the world. The patent standards are very, very high. Lots of research goes into seeing if anyone else has done it before. In copyright, on the contrary, if you write something that's identical to what someone else has written, you can both have a valid copyright as long as you didn't copy theirs. If you were on a desert island when things like La Vida Loca and the Macarena came out, and you came back to civilization, like Gilligan's Island guys getting rescued later, and you wrote those two songs, which everyone's already heard and hate, you could be copyrighted in those songs because you did not copy them. You independently created them. In patent, even if you independently created it, you still can be foreclosed from using it by the patent holder. So patent protects the process. Patent protects the, not facts, but the process, the formulas, all of those things can be protected under patent, but it's a very, very high standard, except when it isn't. And I don't know what they are drinking at the patent office, but I wish they would share, because they have departed so far from what it should be that I'm assuming at some point there'll be a pendulum swing back the other way, because there always is, but they'll patent nothing for 50 years. But right now, yeah. I mean, if you've got the money, go ahead and try, because God knows if they can patent swinging sideways on a swing, there are no rules anymore. The only rule is it'll still cost you $10,000 in 3 or 4 years. Yeah.
I'm kind of baffled by my whole question now because
I have managed to confuse her right out of her own mind. I'm doing
you.
Smart.
You really have, because I was going to ask about was we work on airplanes and there's a lot of technical data, and I'm assuming it's protected under patent. But
no, I wouldn't assume that it might or might not be.
Okay, I'm really not sure how it is. Some of this information is very difficult for us to get to, and we need it to work on airplanes, and we're legally we can get a lot
of trade secrets as well.
But it's not always trade secrets. Some of it we need to work on the airplanes because the FAA has very strict standards on the ways that this can be
that the fact that one government regulation keeps you from complying with another one is, you know,
it's just perfectly reality. Normal.
Yeah. Do you have a question for me?
Well, mostly I was going to ask, what is it? How is that information protected? Why is it so hard to get to? And how can technical drawings and things like that, technical information on the construction of the plane.
Boeing companies like that protect their own stuff, usually through contracts. They will say, anyone who I'm going to show this to, it's basically called trade secret. If you have something that's a secret, and again, if I had one of the red and white cans, the formula for Coca-Cola is the example of trade secret that I always use. Everyone's had a Coke. The formula is literally on a piece of paper in a vault in the Big Red Tower downtown. And it is kept secret just by, it's a recipe, so it couldn't be copyrighted. It's a trade secret. A trade secret is anything you keep secret that's valuable to your business. And it's secret so long as you keep it secret. And as long as you follow the little rules that we lawyers have made for you about what counts as keeping it secret, such as anyone who's going to have it revealed to them has to sign a whole lot of stuff and has to sign away their firstborn child, amongst other things, and has to promise never to give it to anyone else, and all sorts of other Byzantine things. If you go through a lot of those steps, then you're protected by the law to a certain extent from people breaking into your house and reading your formulas.
And yet a lot of these databases that have the technical information will charge you thousands and thousands of dollars for access to it. I mean,
It's valuable information, so they've kept it somewhat secret. And if it's valuable, someone will find a way to make money off of it. It might be patentable, but again, it's all the level of protection any given patented thing is going to be purely decided by the patent holder. Just because I patent something doesn't mean I can't say, okay, everybody, go ahead and use it. I could, you know, cure cancer, patent the vaccine, and then say, go ahead, use it. Now, that's not how pharmaceutical companies usually look at things, but then again, pharmaceutical companies have dedicated millions and millions of dollars into their R&D. They kind of want a return. So they patent the vaccines, they get 17 years or a little more, and profit off of it for that long. But, I mean, I'm not sure I've answered your question, but I'm not sure I understand your question.
I'm not sure I do either. That's why I'm looking at it.
Suppose someone wrote, for example, a history of the English Civil War.
Okay.
What parts of that would be copyrightable?
The expression of the history that you use, how you describe it, how you say it. Someone could not go and copy your prose. But none of the underlying facts, none of your, not even your theories on why the Yorks and the Lancastrians were fighting each other, none of that stuff would... Or if you're doing Cromwell, yeah, there's lots of civil wars.
Cromwell.
If you want to go up to Cromwell and the whole nine yards, England was just kind of one big long civil war for a while there. If you're doing Cromwell, if you want to ask why they had those funny haircuts, you know, none of the theories you come up with are going to be protectable by copyright. Your prose, the words you use, your expression of those ideas is protected. But anytime you're writing something that's factual or useful or in any way valuable to society, that valuable part's not protectable by copyright. That's, again, big distinction between patent and copyright. The useful stuff can be patented sometimes. The useful stuff is not protected by copyright. Copyright's about how it looks or how it sounds.
How does the law determine, depending on, I mean, how much you change?
Well, we've got a couple people kind of waiting to go here.
Okay.
I think she was next.
My question is in regards to parodies. I was under the understanding that if a work was copyrighted, that you could make a parody and that you wouldn't be infringing.
To an extent, that's true. Let me talk a little bit. I think that to get to that question and probably a few others along those lines, let me give you a little more talk. So ideas, not protectable until they're fixed, but your expression of the idea is what you got under copyright. The facts, the useful stuff, it's right out. Once you have something that has been protected, that has a copyright on it, who can use it? Well, people keep wanting to use stuff that's protected. I want to take this song and sample it. I want to take this art and change it and make it into some weird mashup thing that I'm going to do that everyone's going to want. But I want to be able to use their stuff, and I should be able to use it, so I'm changing it. I'm adding value to society. I'm a brilliant artist who can't seem to create something independently, so I want to steal someone else's stuff and make it into something better. Okay, people want to do that. The answer usually is no. There are exceptions to copyright. Copyright protects certain rights. Once I've written my book, I can keep other people from copying it. I can keep other people from transforming it, for instance, making it into a movie. I have the right to make it into a movie or a song
or a routine on ice. You know, whatever I want to do from my book, I have the right to do. One exception is the, what we call the first sale doctrine. Once I sell you a copy of my book, I no longer own that copy. This is where software gets fun, because has anyone ever bought a copy of software?
No,
no you haven't. You have licensed it. You have not bought squat. What you have bought is the disc it is on, or you downloaded it. You haven't bought anything. You have licensed it. So the first sale doctrine does not apply when you have licensed software, because you've never purchased the software. None of you have. So the first sale doctrine, though, I've given you this copy of the book. I've sold you my book. I've given you my book. I'd have to give away. No one wants to buy it. So I've given you a copy of my book. You can do anything you want with it except copy it or tear it up to make art, because that's still transforming my book into something else. But you can read it. You can give it to your friends. You can rent it to your friends, as long as you just have that one copy of it. And that's why software starts, people get upset because, well, they say, oh, we can't sell it because people could give copies of it to everyone. The idea behind the first sale doctrine is it's a tangible thing. Once I've given you that book, I only get money from that first sale. If you want to sell it to other people, if you want to rent it, if you want to do whatever you want with it, I've already made my money and I'm done. That's for the first sale doctrine. Again, it's not going to apply to software because that's always licensed. They're being sneaky. They've got good lawyers. Another exception is fair use. And this is where people really like to run away with the idea. This is where if you read a lot of the Lawrence Lessig stuff, if you read a lot of stuff that's sometimes on EFF, less technical stuff, the more artsy stuff, if you read any of the copyleft people, they've got some great points to make. And I believe a bunch of them. But what they're talking about is how they think it should be. Please be careful. Because just because there's a great argument for why taking someone's art and using it in your own art, or sampling music or things like that should be allowed in our new digital age, and we don't want to make our teenagers all thieves and all of these things, they're great policy reasons, but it's just not true yet. Fair use is not a right. Fair use is a defense against an infringement action. So fair use doesn't even come up until you're in court. And if you have infringed badly enough of something that someone cares enough about that they're going to stick the lawyers on you, you've already lost. Because we do not work for cheap. And defending against an infringement suit is going to be expensive, time-consuming, and take an emotional toll on you, assuming I'm talking to y'all as individuals, not as parts of a big corporation. Big corporations, we don't worry about their emotions. Individual humans, trials really suck. And so before you use something, just going through and saying, oh, I've got a really good fair use argument, that just means that you may or may not get away with it after you've spent thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars on a lawyer. And same thing with a parody. Technically, parody is one of the fair uses. If you are going to make a parody of something, it is deemed a use that is fair, technically. There have been a lot of really expensive lawsuits about exactly that. So you've got your idea of a parody, and if you're going to make something, but there are rules about that too. It has to be a parody of the underlying work, but it can't be used just to make yours more famous or more accessible. So there was a Dr. Seuss prose about the OJ trial. Law school books are out of date by definition. But there was someone who wrote a piece of poetry of sorts in Dr. Seussian prose about the OJ trial. It's really very amusing. But there's no reason to use Dr. Seuss prose to talk about O.J. Simpson. Y'all remember O.J. Simpson. so there's no reason to use Dr. Seuss to talk about O.J. Simpson. So you're just using the Dr. Seuss prose to get your thing more noticed or more popular or better. So you can't do that. Now, if you're going to do what one thing that was found to be prose that or was found to be parody that worked was the Two Live Crew remake of Pretty Woman. They took some of the Roy Orbison song and used it in their song. And that was deemed to be a parody because Pretty Woman is kind of a happy little innocent song. And the argument ran, and their lawyer won, so they were correct. But their lawyer was paid for by the big record company that recorded it for them, and the millions they had made on this song. Their lawyer argued successfully that it was that their use of that song was a parody because they were making fun of the innocent naivete of the Roy Orbison song, and in their world, that kind of innocence doesn't exist, and they're making fun of it. I feel like his world better. But regardless, that was deemed a parody. So was The Wind Done Gone, which was an example of one of the best copyright lawyers in Atlanta who represented the woman who wrote that and convinced Judge Birch to write one of his stupidest opinions ever. He's a very smart judge. And he found that thing to be parody, even though it's not funny, even though it's purely just a knockoff. They were convinced of that. So sometimes fair use is whatever the judge is convinced it is. But it's not usually wise to rely on that if you have another way to do it. Now, if you're doing fan stuff or something like that, they don't usually care. If you're not going to be making money off of it, it still is infringement. Don't make that mistake also. Just because you're not going to make money, either on purpose or just out of the reality of the market, doesn't mean it's not copyright infringement. If you copy someone else's work, you are infringing. You may get away. Chances are you'll fly under their radar, none will care. But if the lawyers come after you, it goes badly for you, as a general rule. Has that come close to your question, at least? Because I kind of wanted to add some information in there. So fair use, there's a number of statutory elements, but it has been really torn apart by the litigators. And you can't rely on the simple language of the code. It seems like a very simple analysis of what is and is not fair use. And I could go through those elements and explain them to you, and you would think you had a very good understanding of it, and then I could show you five cases that flew straight in the face of what you just learned. And some of them are Supreme Court cases. So it's just one of those areas where it's really, really marshy. There is a lovely article by a very well-respected Second Circuit judge written 15 years ago, before some of the transformative use garbage got into common lexicon. And he said, wow, you know, no one knows what the hell this means. And he's like, I'm fairly certain in the next decade or two, judiciary will take this approach and we will start coming to a more rational approach to fair use. Because right now, oh my God, I do this for a living, I'm a judge for pity's sake, and no one gets it. It's gotten worse since he wrote that article. So it's, you know, yes, fair use is allowable, but if you're going to make any headlines with it, you might get in a lot of trouble because it's not a good idea to rely on it. Now, again, Lawrence Lessig and a lot of folks make really good arguments for why it should be allowed, but it's not yet. Yeah.
I was curious about the interplay between copyright and trademark in situations like the best one I can think of off the top of my head is Tarzan, where individual works may have fallen into the public domain, but the character itself is tightly controlled and trademarked by an estate or a corporation.
Well, the name Tarzan may be trademarked, and you can trademark attributes like a drawing or something like that to represent Tarzan. The characters are copyrightable. So the characters from the original book are copyrightable to the extent the original book has not yet fallen into the public domain, and it probably has by now. But some of the later works probably have not.
Right.
But if the original works in the public domain, you can take from that original work. Now, to the extent the estate has managed to make Tarzan into a trademark, you can't use it to market your goods. But you can safely use it in literature to the extent that it's not still protected by some of the later works. And that's where it gets a little dicey with, well, what are you taking? Are you taking from the public domain version? Are you taking from something still protected? And that's one where you would really need to sit down and figure out what exactly is protected. I'm a big Edgar Rice Burroughs fan, but I got to tell you, I don't know how much of that still is protected and how much is not.
Right. I will admit that mostly I just saw that all of the recent derivative works, movies, video games, toys, things like that, all had to have the stamp of approval from the Burroughs estate and wanted to know.
Well, probably the copyright and the character still is existent, or they were at least wise enough to follow the advice that I'm going to give you right now, which is if you're wanting to use something like a famous character, that's not obviously in the public domain, if you want to make a parody of something, if you want to use someone's work in your own derivative work, ask. If you get permission, then you can do it. And a lot of times, people don't mind. Now, I mean, if you're talking about Star Trek characters, don't bother writing to Paramount. They're not going to answer you. But if you're talking about a character in an actual author's book, you know, write Anne McCaffrey. Ask her if she minds. If she says, no, go ahead, just don't sell it, well then, go ahead, just don't sell it. If you want to use someone's art, if something, well, I was going to say Shepard Fairey, but he'll never let you use anything for free. If you have someone's artwork that you've seen that's really inspired you, and you would like to take a photograph of it, and cut it up into pieces, and move it around, and do something else, and make something really inspiring to you, and then display it, well, once you display it, you're going to be in trouble. Well, ask. If you get permission, then you're not infringing. And oftentimes, that's the best way to do it. I have, talking about the book, because it's kind of on my brain, I had to kind of take the step, again, with a fair use argument. When I teach in classroom, I can use pretty much anything I damn well want, because it's educational. Now, I can't have copies made at Kinko's. But if I want to play a couple songs in my class so we can talk about whether they've been infringed or not, if I want to show two pieces of artwork and say, gee, have they, you know, are they too close to be infringing? If I want to excerpt something out of an article or out of a book, as long as I don't start making copies because that runs afoul of one of the silly cases that violates the simple rules of the statute, I can do a lot. Well, once I was putting it in a book to sell it, and I hadn't noticed this, this is why I was very amused that me, the IP lawyer, had to be reminded by my editor that technically this isn't education, this is for profit. I'm like, oh, come on, we're not going to make any money. But yeah, I get your point. We are going to try to sell this textbook, and so someone might buy it. So this is actually now a commercial use, which takes me out of that educational exemption. But so I wrote to the guys that I wanted to quote and asked them. And they all said, sure. Because Lawrence Lessig is one. I keep mentioning him. He's the copyleft guy who came up with Creative Commons. And he is the one, I promise to tell you, is the exception to the rule of don't download anything and use it. The stuff from the Creative Commons, their licenses are excellent. The GPL license from the GNU guys. Are we supposed to call them new? I keep wondering. I mean, I keep thinking of
new. Yeah.
Are we supposed to call them new GPL? Okay.
Yeah.
But new as in the animal, not as opposed to old. Their GPL and the Creative Commons licenses are freely available, and they are ways that if you make something that you would like people to be able to use, you can release it under one of these licenses. You put on if you go to their website, creativecommons.org or gpl.org, I think, it has copies of those licenses you can read. They have human-friendly text at the beginning, so it tells you what's in the contract, and they are correct. Their summaries of their licenses are accurate. Feel free to rely on them. These are very good products. They are absolutely free. And if you're creating something, realistically, you kind of want people to use it and share it and spread it out, because that's the best way in the modern market, unless you're already a huge name, that's the best way to get your work out there. So if you want to record your music and say, sure, download this, give it to your friends, but tell them where you got it. There's a license for that on Creative Commons. If you're making artwork and you would love people to see your art because you want them to know it and one day want to buy one from you, say, sure, copy it off my website, use it in your stuff, whatever, just make sure you say where you got it from so they can come back and buy it from me later when they're inspired. And that's how most things become successful now if you don't have a huge corporation behind you to promote it. So these ideas of the free use licenses are great because you can say you can use it as long as you're not going to exploit it commercially. You can say you can use it for anything you want. You can say you can use it, but you have to attribute to me. There are lots of different variations on those licenses, and they are excellent. You can use those safely. And it's a way to share things, and a lot of things are released under those licenses. So look, if you see something on the internet, does it say Creative Commons? Well then, chances are you can use it. But that was one. Lessig's books are freely available online, and he's like the big into the sharing, and I wanted to use a big chunk of his book to explain copyleft, because law students don't usually get taught about this. It's kind of anarchist, so we kind of stay away from it. But I was thinking, well, I need to use this chunk, and that's when I realized his Creative Commons license says you may use this and reproduce this freely as long as it's not a commercial use. And suddenly, oh crap, I'm a commercial use. So I wrote Professor Lessig and said, hey, can I use this? And I was kind of hoping he wouldn't, because it made a really great story. He said, hell no, you can't use my article about sharing things freely. And of course he did, because he's not a hypocrite, damn it. It would have been a much better story if he had, but he was very gracious and said, oh yes, of course, please feel free to use it. I'm happy to have people read my stuff. He's actually a very nice guy. Damn it. So, ask. get permission. Look for a Creative Commons license, because that's people who are freely willing to share. If the thing you want to use isn't, you can't get permission for it, and no one will let you use it, well, steal something else. Don't do something that's going to get you in trouble. I think you were next.
Well, I'd just like to make a quick note as well that all the audio from the tracks on this, all the audio from the panels on this track, will be on the EF Forums website and will be released under a Creative Commons license.
There you go.
EFforums.net.
Okay, so I'm a writer and I have a short story and I create and I get copyright as soon as I get it written in tangible form. Mm-hmm.
And if you care about it, you're going to register it anyway.
Well, that's the gist of the question. I send it off to an anthology for submission. They accept it. They register it as part of the anthology. Do I still have to register it separately as a separate work?
It depends on what they're doing. I would read carefully the contract with them, because they may be saying by publishing it in our anthology, we own the copyright. And that if you want to use the story again later, you will have to ask for permission from them.
Yeah, well, they didn't do that, so... But
are you sure?
Yes.
Okay. Yes. Then yes, register it.
Okay.
And it's been registered as part of the anthology, but what's protected there is the selection and arrangement. The underlying work, if they didn't register the underlying work, it has not been registered. The copyright still retains in you if you haven't given it away. Register.
Okay.
I think our musketeer over here is next.
All right, so one of the murky waters of the music industry is some of these groups will actually disband and they are no longer together. And so if we were wanting to use one of their works, which they have on their website, now defunct, as yes, you can use it, and, or no, they don't say yes, you can use it. This is how you perform it, but they don't specifically say this, you can use it.
Where does whoever's left holding the rights. If there's a songwriter who, if you want to make a recording, if you're doing music, then there's often a compulsory license just to find out who you pay it to. If you want to use the music in a different way that wouldn't be covered by the compulsory license, then you got to find whoever still owns the rights. And that's not always easy. The Copyright Office is in the process of trying to make a useful database, like all of you assume exists already, it doesn't. If you assume that, oh, if I want to find out who owns this copyright, I'll go to copyright.gov, because she gave me that, and I'll go to the database and I'll search. There isn't one yet. They're working on it.
Mm-hmm.
Decades after you would have thought that it would have been there. They're working on it, and there's more than there used to be. Trademarks are all easily searchable online, which is great. You used to have to go to Washington to do it, which meant you had to pay someone who was in Washington to go do it and hope they got it right. But it's getting there. But right now, one of the big murky things in copyright is who actually owns the copyright? Is that person dead? When did they die? Because copyright, at least under modern terms, is attributed from when the person died. Old copyright was at whether they filed a renewal and when the renewal expired. It's very Byzantine, and there aren't any good records. So a lot of times the answer is, hell, we don't know. Someone probably owns it, but we don't know who. And it takes a little detective work to find out who owns it. If it was professionally released, the record company probably owns some rights. If not, if they're just a garage band, then whoever wrote the song, who had the author credit, get that, and you can't use their sound recording, but if you want to use the underlying composition, you don't care about the sound recording anyway, you care about the composition, find the songwriter and get his or her permission. But it's not always easy, and there's not a simple click here to find it out.
The second one, I'm hoping you can debunk this pretty quickly, but
Not. If it's really stupid, it's probably true.
Yeah, I've heard it said that if something is recorded and put out in music-wise, something is actually recorded, that a group can do their own cover of it, but they only have to go back in order to get permission if they want to record it themselves.
Even if you're performing it, you usually have to pay the compulsory license. That's an ASCAP or a BMI kind of thing. Most times, if you can do a cover, and a cover is allowed, but you need to be doing it under the compulsory license. And there's some paperwork you fill out and a price that you pay, and you're allowed. You don't have to negotiate a new price, but that's usually how it works. Now, what they say there is probably on the, if you're just performing it somewhere small where no one that owns the copyright is likely to be, chances are you won't get caught. So to the extent that not getting caught means can do it permissibly in your world, then yeah. Once you record it, you're more likely to get caught. If you're just performing it, it depends how good you are and how many people are listening, and if any of them happen to know the guy that actually owns it. So, but there's a, but to do covers, just look up the compulsory license and you can probably get the permission. But it does cost a little.
If you're if you're writing a book and you're having illustrations done too, should they be done separately or all in one book?
Whoever's doing the illustrations owns the copyright in the illustration.
Okay.
You will need to make sure that you have a license agreement with the illustrator giving you the right to use the book, and then that's where some negotiation comes in. Do you want to have the right to reproduce and sell those that artwork, or should the artist still have that? How much you pay the artist probably is going to depend on how many rights you get from it. You will send a copy of the book as it is, and the artist, if he's going to retain the copyright, will register it separately as well.
Okay.
I have still got questions.
What's the difference between I wrote it, it's copyrighted, and I actually send it in and register it as a copyright?
The difference is the scope of your rights. Basically, if you ever want to sue to protect it, it has to be registered. There are other things, too, that have to do with damages that are allowable and those sorts of things. There's a lot of detail to it. The basic rule is if you ever want to sue to protect your copyrights, if you care about it, and you might actually say, hey, quit infringing that, if it's not registered, you can't.
Is it possible to will a...
Sorry, one thing I want to say also to that. The other thing about that is once you've registered it, it's a lot easier to prove that it's yours and that it's copyrighted. Because if I, technically, now that it's on your computer, it's protected. Okay, so someone copies it from you and says, oh, I just wrote it. You say, dude, I wrote it 10 years ago. Look, here's my registration receipt. Come on. You can prove that you wrote it first and that he was likely to copy it. So it gives you a great, it gives you the ability to say, no, I was first. You're knocking me off, not the other way around. He may come, yeah, because what's happened more than once, someone wrote something, someone else got a hold of it and said, oh, I like that. And the second guy who got famous with it, and the first guy says, hey, that's mine. And the second guy, the one who stole it, says, no, no, you stole it from me. And if he's got better lawyers, he might win. So if you have registered it, then you've got proof that at least by that point, you had created it. So it's worth the $35. Yeah.
Can you pass pass a copyright by will?
Yes. I can do it. I can answer them with one word. I can do it. I can do it. I can do it. Quick, someone else has a question. I think this is the first time ever I've succeeded that.
If you have, for example, a copyrighted work, say a novel,
okay.
And that is at a later point, it's registered and it's registered as a copyright in its original format,
right.
And it's protected and it's not owned by contract by anyone other than the register.
Okay.
If that is later turned into, say, like an electronic media,
uh-huh.
Does that need to be recopyrighted because it's in a new media, or is it still covered?
There'll be two different copyrights at that point. The original author will own the underlying work's copyright. It will have the original duration of copyright, whether it's under the old act before 1976, which was two fixed terms, or whether it's the new one, which is life of the author plus terms beyond that. So the underlying work, the term of that work and protection does not change. What you're talking about when you make it into a video game or whatever is it becomes a derivative work. And the derivative work will whatever the derivative work is added to or changed from the original work, the changes or the new stuff get a new copyright. So if I translate my book from English to German, God help me, or if I take my painting and take photographs of it and sell the photographs of the painting, the only thing that would be, those are transforming it, but not much. So whatever I've added that's new, if I do a sequel, if I do a movie from my novel, whatever is added that's new, now in the movie, tons is being added, it's now visual. All of the new stuff that's added is protected under a new copyright. The original stuff does not take a new copyright at this point. This is something that mattered more when copyrights were shorter. But if I wrote my novel and you did your movie and my novel falls into the public domain, all that's protected in your movie is the original bits that you've added. Someone else can still take my story that's now in the public domain and make a new movie out of it. As long as they don't copy the movie bits from you, as long as all they're using is my now unprotected work, they can freely use it. So the derivative work, only the new bits are protected. Does that answer your question?
Actually, specifically if it's the exact same work, just in a new medium, like a existing book turned into an ebook. So it's the same words, same format.
Then it's like a distribution rights agreement.
Okay.
No copyright will take. It's just in a different format. But putting it in a different format, the right to distribute is protected by the author. And the ebooks thing is a whole different category because that's been an interesting legal journey. Apparently Google now owns all of us, whether we opt in or not. But
I didn't know that. I thought the settlement was actually terminated because the lawyer said, or the judge said, that they have until September 15th to come to a new agreement.
It's not September 15th. The Google thing has just defied logic and law so many times that it's the e-books rights. The problem is, just a few years ago, e-books were not necessarily part of a publishing contract. Now, of course, it is. And the answer is the publisher owns the rights to it because that's in the standard contract. It used to not be because these didn't exist. So when we say, oh, well, can I take this old book and put it on, can Google scan it and put it in their library? If the author wants to distribute it in e-books, can the author get more money out of the publisher to put it on e-books? And that was all basically a matter of what was in the original contract because no one had thought about it yet. And there was a lot of weird results that came out, and then Google said, oh, we're just going to scan everything, okay? And, it just got strange from there. But the reality now is, in your original publishing contract, they'll be covered.
Can you briefly touch on...
I can't briefly do anything.
Well, then touch on the subject of digital media that you purchase, for instance, we'll use an audio CD as an example. Taking that and making a digital backup copy of that to another form of media for archival purposes for your personal use?
That is exempted out of the law. If you have a digital format, you are allowed to make an archival copy for yourself. You're allowed to distribute it. But you're allowed to make a backup, basically, yes.
Okay.
There are little carve-outs here and there, but the basic rule is if you own the CD, you can make a backup because we all know that CDs scratch and are worthless, so you're allowed to make that archival copy. You're not allowed to share it. You're not allowed to do a lot of other things with it, but that is an accepted use.
Okay. Was there not any court cases? I thought I had heard of court cases where they had used the evidence of the media on the hard disk as
this is a general
fuel for the fire,
rule. Clicked I agree to something in which you have agreed not to make an archival copy, then you have given up your right to make that archival copy. That stuff you're agreeing to, guys, there's all kinds of shit they hide in there. There is one, I kid you not, from Microsoft for one of their old products, one of their old operating systems. This was back, when did I write the article? 2002, I think. So that long ago, there's a EULA at the end of this product by Microsoft, their operating system. And it literally disclaimed responsibility or liability for any nuclear holocaust caused by their product. It made me very hesitant to use my computer for a while because I'm not real technical. The fact that I often teach technology law just cracks me up. But I wasn't sure how misusing my computer could do that. And so I was afraid that since I always do find the bugs, that would be the one I found. But there's all kinds of stuff in those things that you just clicked I agree to. And if in that agreement you said, I will not make an archival copy, then you've given up your right under the law to have an archival copy. License agreements are sneaky. License agreements are the I agree by clicking here, or shrink wrap agreements, we call them, this is funny because we're lawyers. Originally, it was a shrink wrap agreement. That's when you still bought your CDs or you bought your software in a box at a store. By virtue of breaking open the shrink wrap, the terms in the contract inside that box now bound you. That flies in the face of most law. But for these agreements, it was deemed enforceable. So whatever was in that piece of paper that fell out of the box was enforceable by virtue of you opening the shrink wrap. So it's called a shrink wrap agreement. Well, then a year passed and technology moved, and now you're clicking on it. And so because we're lawyers, we like things to still feel familiar. We call it click wrap agreements. There's no wrapping involved. We still call them click wrap because it was shrink wrap and now it's click wrap. It's kind of like adding gate to any scandal, just because it happened at a hotel in Washington 30 years ago, 40 years ago, God, how long ago. So the click wrap agreements are enforceable, and you're giving away all kinds of rights. They are taking away a lot of your rights that you would otherwise have under copyright. If you purchased a copy of software on a disk or purchased a copy downloaded, you would have all of the rights that you're given under the Copyright Act. And these guys are making you give them up. A lot of the rights that you would have to use or to share or to make archival copies If you have agreed not to do it by clicking I agree or by opening the box, then you can't. You're bound by contract, and contract trumps the default statutes.
Yeah, in copyright in music, is it still the PA and SR form you got to fill out?
I'm sorry, what?
When you copyright in music, is it still the PA and SR form?
Everything's online, and they'll direct you to the correct form to fill out.
Okay.
You don't have the old paper forms are kind of obsolete now.
Yeah,
and
I noticed that.
It's actually a lot easier, because basically you go through the process, it asks you what the work is, and it'll take you to the right place.
Okay.
And if you're not certain as you go through, like I said, call the reference lawyers, and they will make sure you get to the exact right form.
And also, I don't know how to access, but I remember a long time ago, Michael Jackson outbid Paul McCartney on the Beatles rights.
Mm-hmm.
How is that possible if
Paul McCartney didn't own the rights anymore. His record company had owned the rights for years and years and years, and they got residuals under their recording contracts, but the record company owned the actual rights, and the record company sold them. And Michael Jackson was richer than Paul McCartney, so Michael Jackson owned the Lennon McCartney library for a while, because Lennon McCartney hadn't owned them, for quite some time.
Suppose I want to write a book, work of fiction, but I'm going to base a lot of the descriptions on experiences that I've had, apartments that I've lived in, people that I've known. What are my rights and restrictions? What can I get away with if I'm basing this, loosely basing it, or even not so loosely basing, on real people that I've known in my life?
Change the names, they don't sue you.
But they don't
have any copyright in what happened between the two of them.
Is that all I need to do?
But if you say nasty things about them,
mm-hmm.
That's slander or liable to be whether you're saying it or writing it. But if you say nasty things on people, they get pissed and they sue you. If you don't call them by that name, if you're not trying to make it a historical thing where who people are matters, then yeah, just change it enough so it's not recognizable. That way you won't piss them off. Now again, that's not a copyright question so much as a let's don't piss people off and get sued question. So make it so that it doesn't piss them off, because they won't necessarily recognize themselves.
So if Jack becomes Bob and looks exactly like Jack and sounds exactly like Jack and has clothes just like Jack, but he's Bob now.
Well, dress him differently.
Okay, I'm just wondering how much of a...
Give him a different accent. Make it so that, it makes... So as long... Again, if you're trying to write a historical novel of your life, well, then you're going to have to make them identifiable. If you're just trying to tell a story, change them enough that it stays true to what's in your head, but won't piss them off. And besides, if you make a character seem really, really stupid, no one will think it's them.
I apologize. I got here late, but I wanted to clarify something. You talked about writing works for contract and that sort of thing. If you have a copyright notice on a work and the contract does not specify who retains copyright, do you in fact retain copyright?
I have no idea. You've lost me.
So let's say somebody hires me to write a script. I put a copyright notice on the script, copyright my company.
The copyright notice isn't going to matter. What's going to matter is the terms of the contract.
But if they have nothing, if it says nothing about who holds copyright,
then the person who wrote it owns it.
Thank you.
But if you say otherwise in your contract, then that may or may not control work made for hire is a little bit different too. Chances are, if as an author you give away your rights, unless you are in a work made for hire, which is a very narrow situation and seldom applies to real people, if the work made for hire little section doesn't apply, you still have given away your rights, but 35 years from the date you give them away, you can get them back if you wish.
But if there's nothing in the contract, somebody says,
and the case in question, somebody hires me to write a murder mystery for them for $500, and there's nothing in the contract that says who owns the work. Then I own it free and clear, and they don't have a thing to say.
Well, a court will probably assume that they got something for their $500. So they will be, they would be assumed to have some right to use it. But it depends what the contract says. The contract's probably giving them something. Did they want to use it for a murder mystery party? Did they want to use it to do a movie?
A single performance, yeah.
Okay,
used for
well,
a single
if that's
performance.
What they want you to do it for, then even if their contract is that badly written, chances are the judge will say, look, they paid you for something. The whole purpose here was so they could perform it. So they've gotten the right to perform it. You can't stop them from using whatever the purpose was intended for. But if you haven't given away any more rights than that performance right, then you still hold the rest of them. The example we use when we teach, because we're very boring and have no original thoughts, is a bundle of sticks. I'm holding a bundle of sticks, which together make my copyright. And I can give away pieces of it. I can give you a stick, and I can give you a stick, and I can hand them out if I'm out of them sticks. But each stick that I've given away means what I'm holding is less. I mean, because once I've given it away, someone else has it. Now, the copyright law allows me 35 years later to collect them back up. But 35 years from now, I may not care anymore. So, but if you have given away that performance right to them, then they can do that. But everything else, you're still holding. If you've given away the performance right and a few others, then they have those and you don't anymore, and you've got whatever else you have not yet given away. The author retains the rights until he gives them away. Yes?
Okay. I think you might have answered this, but if you rework words like on a nursery rhyme or a song that's just a folk song, could you copyright those? Or
to the extent you have done something new, your new addition to it, and I'm assuming if the underlying works in the public domain.
Yes.
If the underlying works in the public domain, then whatever you have done that is new and different, you will hold the right to if you register it. But you do not gain any rights to the original Mother Goose or anything.
No.
Other people can freely use that, and whatever remains in your work of that original work, you do not own. All you own is what you have added. Copyright is going to give you the protection to your creative efforts. No amount of trying to call it something else is going to give you the rights to someone else's.
So it would be just the words, not the music.
If you're putting new words to someone else's music, you will own your words.
Okay.
And you better make sure that music's in the public domain.
Okay.
I haven't been watching that.
We're
15
over.
We're over.
Yeah.
Oops.
You can squish another box in the tin if you want.
We're over time.